effort has just been washed down the drain. Maybe that helps a little bit. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, let's describe Grommet, because maybe a lot of people on the net and all never heard of it before, not much into home brewing. Grommet actually looks like a water washer that you would use on a faucet, but it has like a hole. Yeah, it has a hole in the middle, a donut hole in the middle. Or I can even say it looks like a donut with a groove cut around the edge. There's a groove cut into it around the edge that grips the chassis on either side. You drill a hole to accommodate the grommet by measuring with some means the exact depth of the groove on each side. In other words, what is the width of the groove? Not the outer portion of the donut, but at that groove that's cut in there. You want to know what that size is, so that when you drill the hole, then you can press this grommet in. It'll have ways to grab the chassis on each side. I guess there's a simple explanation for what a grommet is, Dick, for those who...
It's a mechanical question.
Over.
Yeah, I'm going to go one step beyond. Let's assume that Mel just picked up a grommet that's 1 inch in diameter, for simplicity. The grommet, it looks like a donut, it's 1 inch in diameter. And around the outer perimeter, all the way around 360 degrees, there's a groove cut into it. And the groove, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air, the groove is an eighth of an inch of depth. So that now, if I take my calipers and I put them around the outside of this grommet, my calipers measure 1 inch of diameter. I shift my blades of my calipers over a little bit, so they're now going inside the groove of the grommet, because the grommet has got a depth of 1/8 inch all the way around. My calipers will now measure 3/4 of an inch. I've taken away an eighth of an inch twice by moving the blades of the calipers into that groove. So because the groove has a depth diameter of 3/4 of an inch, if I now drill a 3/4 of an inch hole in the chassis and I properly install that grommet, that groove is now going to pick up the metal of the chassis, the grommet is going to be beautifully captured, and now all the wires that I put through the center of that round black grommet are going to be protected from chafing of the chassis as those wires go through that grommet. Wonder if that helps a little bit, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Very good description, Dick. Because, you know, grommets now are coming in more and more into use, especially mobiling. If you're going to pass a wire from your battery through the firewall someplace, you got to make sure that that wire isn't going to get through a sharp edge somewhere, you know, and you try to squeeze it through. It's pretty hard on some of the new cars to find a spot. But if you're going to go through someplace, you're squeezing it through, and that wire is going to get cut possibly through by the edge of the metal, you're going to wonder, first of all, as we always suggested, that you do battery as close to the terminals of the battery as you can get. Because this is a perfect example that if that ever was across the battery without fuses, this wire got cut into without some kind of a rubber grommet or whatever, you are going to have some major trouble in that car. And I guess if you have to drill a hole, you better be able to insert a grommet. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, with modern-day automobiles, all of that salt spray and the rain and everything else that you drive through has to be shielded from the passenger compartment of the car. Therefore, all of the wiring that goes through that firewall of the car, that goes into your fuse panel and goes into your instrument panel, has to be beautifully protected, grommeted, mechanically supported with weatherproof connectors. A lot of thought goes into that, because potentially that could give you a lot of trouble. If a salt spray from the road was able to hide in certain spots inside of that wiring bundle, it can create a lot of grief downrange. So that the best of all worlds, you'd like to hope that the gauge of the wire from the battery through your firewall into your fuse panel is heavy enough that if you find ways of tapping into the fuse panel, you could find enough power to power your radio from the inside of the car. That would be nice. But if you're doing something like putting in a Mirage 1016 amplifier, that's the one that puts out 160 watts. It draws 20 amperes or 25 amperes. The wiring at your fuse panel inside your automobile probably cannot tolerate 25 additional amperes compared to the normal current that flows through that fuse panel. As such, you've got to put a separate piece of 8-gauge wire with a fuse at the battery that goes from the battery through that instrument, through that firewall, and into the passenger compartment. Let me drop. And now the question is, can you find a way of taking the rubber grommet that's already there and stretching it or whatever and sneaking your particular wire through? That's not easy. Or if you're going to drill your own hole in the firewall, that's not easy. You've got to very carefully choose a spot that you're not going to drill into something that's vital on the other side. And then you've got to protect that hole in two or three different ways. The wire that you send through there has to be properly protected so that no sharp edge of the metal can dig through the insulation of that wire. That's insulation protection. It has to be properly mechanically supported so that all the shake, rattle, and roll of the car does not create a failure of that whole mechanism at a later stage. And that whole assembly has got to be extremely well weatherproof. You don't want the salt spray from the road to be spraying through that hole and getting into the passenger compartment. So it's going to take a great big glob of Celastic adhesive or whatever downrange. You've got to do all kinds of fancy cabling and tie wrapping and whatever of the wiring. You better go slow on this operation because there's lots of ways you can get yourself in trouble. When you've had to bring a 20 ampere 12 volt wire through a firewall, I wonder how often you've done that, Mel, and I bet you lost some sleep over that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
My old Chevy, that's my mobile. I keep that as my mobile, my toy. And I got all that HF equipment in them, VHF and UHF. I got how many antennas on the car? Usually it can have the HF antenna, VHF, UHF, a 2-meter. No, UHF antenna, the 2-meter antenna, regular antenna and all. So I never had any problem through that car with all the room and everything, drilling through the firewalls and all, putting in grommets, filling them up and all. Pretty powerful, those old cars, you know, and like I say, it's strictly used for me as my toy, my mobile. But I looked at the new one we have, a new Nissan 2011 Maxima, and I wouldn't even think about putting mobile into this thing by any of those. I just said, forget it. Not going to be a mobile operator from this thing. If I do, I'll just use my handy talkie or whatever. Something I can maybe run off of my own battery or whatever. I just can't bring myself to doing anything like that at this point, Dick, over.
I wouldn't give up so easily, Mel. If it's a well-wired cigarette lighter, in the case of my Toyota Camry, it has a pair, count them, two cigarette lighters. One of them is really intended for a cigarette lighter, and believe it or not, that's the one that's got a big voltage drop. And the second one is a cigarette lighter-like plug, which is intended for powering auxiliary equipment. And I power my 30-watt Kenwood 751A through that, and it works very well if the engine is running. If the engine is not running, and the voltage goes down to 11.9 volts under transmit power, the Kenwood 751 goes into all kinds of crazy glitches when it sees anything less than 12.0 volts. But I think you found out your 817 will go all the way down to 8.8 volts. So you'd have no trouble operating in my car from that auxiliary 12-volt cigarette lighter-like plug. And I think you would have no trouble pulling 10 amperes out of that one. So you wouldn't have to change the wiring of the car. The antenna you'd be putting on the top would be a mag mount. The mag mount would have a piece of coax cable, RG58 cable, that comes into the rear right-hand door of the four-door sedan. You'd wrap the wire around the perimeter of the door and bring the wire in at the bottom of the door across the rubber grommet of the door. And that way, way you're bringing in the RG58 cable wouldn't be leaking water into the car. So now, and you'd have to use some duct tape to hold it around the perimeter. So now you're doing no modifications of the car in any way. You're not scratching the paint because it's a mag mount with a nice piece of plastic underneath. You're not modifying the firewall, and you're using the auxiliary plug in my car, and you could run a 30-watt rig from that with essentially no problem. K2KEY, K2OUT.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You've got it, Mel.
KC2MDP.
Go ahead, Steve. Tell us how you would do that, and then pass it over to Mel. You got it, Steve.
WA2RYY with a comment.
WA2RYY recognized. Okay, Dick, I've got four radios in my car, four mobile radios, and I've never drilled a hole for the antennas, power, or anything. What I did as far as the power cords, you know, the power line from the batteries, most of the newer cars, at least mine is, the grommet is like molded around the wire. So getting sneaking another wire through there is almost impossible to begin with. As far as what I did there is I just took a razor knife, and next to where that molded piece is around the wire, I just put a little slit, passed my wire through, and took silicone sealant and sealed them up. As far as the antennas, there are various little plugs, like rubber grommets almost, plugs that I think they use them for when they spray the weather sealant, you know, the weatherproofing sealant on the car. And what I did is I did the same thing. Took a razor knife, slit those, ran my antenna cable through them, took a little bit of black silicone, sealed them up, and I'm good to go. Back to you, Dick.
Now, the antenna wire that went through the rubber grommet of the door, is that how you did that, Steve?
Yes, basically, Dick. What my car is I've got a Ford Explorer, so it's got the hatchback. And you pop the hatchback, and what I did is, that, you know, the space there, I ran the wire down, and next to the taillight, there's a rubber grommet that I think, you know, they pull it out, and they spray the undercoating or whatever inside the car. So what I did is, that's the way I got into the car, is I popped that, you know, I just basically popped that out, put a little slit in it, passed my wire through it, and just sealed it up with some black silicone. Once I'm in the car, I can do whatever I want. Back to you.
Beautiful. So once again, you found a way of not defacing the vehicle itself and yet establishing your coax antenna to the outside of the car and establishing your power through the firewall. Let's see how Joe does it. How do you not deface a car and get the power and coax through it, Joe? W-H-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Well, my comment is not directly on not defacing the car. I've just simply drilled a hole where applicable and make sure that I'm not drilling into something on the other side of it as crucial, like a brake line, air conditioning tubing, or something like that. My comment was related to somebody who intends to hook up the power underneath the dashboard of the car or to a cigarette lighter. What you might want to consider doing before you do that is to take a digital VOM, put it on AC, and run the car and turn on some of the accessories and see how much ripple you have at that point right there before you intend to cut into that wire permanently, because some radios can and some radios cannot handle the amount of ripple that might be introduced at that particular point. You could have very easily 300, 400, 500 millivolts of ripple on that line to ground. Back to you, Dick.
Joe, have you actually seen that amount of ripple on some particular vehicles? And if you did, is there a particular solution to that one that you know of? Over to you, Joe.
I've never tried to filter something like that out. I've always tried to put stuff through the firewall to the battery, because the closer you get to the battery, the better off you are as far as acting like a huge storage capacitor and keeping the electrical noise of the car, filtered down quite a bit. A lot of times when you look at the dashboard wiring in the car, it seems to be partially between the alternator and the battery. So you stand a pretty good chance of having some sort of amount of ripple or noise on the wiring if you intend to use it, especially if you're going to be pulling 10 or 15 amps off of it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We've all heard a few guys who have quite a bit of alternator whine on their 2-meter transmitter. because the dashboard where they're getting the power from is essentially in between the alternator and the battery. In cases like that, you'd be tempted to say, well, I'll put a great big inductor in there, a 1 Henry choke that's rated for 10 amperes, and I'll get rid of the ripple. Well, be careful, because when your transmitter goes between the transmit mode where it's drawing 20 amps and the receive mode where it's drawing a quarter of an ampere, the inductive kickback of that particular choke is going to give you a spike of voltage of 100 volts, unless you put the right kind of a Zener diode, a power Zener diode in there to absorb that spike, the inductive kickback, that could do some damage to your radio. So filtering it is not easy. Whereas if you run a twisted pair, 8-gauge wire, red and black, and you run that through the firewall right up to the battery is approximately a 1 farad capacitor. My goodness, is that a filter. You could have the ugliest alternator in the world charging that battery, and that battery is going to filter the living daylights out of that. And now with fuses on both the negative and the positive lead, right at the battery, on your twisted pair, that's now powering your rig, you could power 200 and 300 watt transmitter in the car and make it all pretty safe. Let's see, any further comments on this one from Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, just going to say he brought up another good point. Like on the 817, gotta be very careful with that little radio. Some things are very unforgiving in it. Yes, the radio will work down at 9.6 volts and work well. The only thing is you've got to really be cautious on that radio is do never reverse the battery. Don't get your positive and negative mixed up. If you do, you will do damage to that radio. I don't know how many other radios on the market. I understand there are a few QRP radios that suffer the same kind of a situation, that if you reverse wires on a power supply, it will damage those radios quite a bit. They don't have any built-in, internal provision for that. So what is suggested, you may have seen it in QST, a number of people have asked that question, what do you suggest? And there's a thing called a bilateral diode. A bilateral diode usually takes care of it. You want to describe a bilateral diode, Dick? Go ahead.
Now, one possible way would be that diode has a full-wave bridge rectifier of 4 diodes inside, so that no matter what polarity you put on the outside, it always gets exactly the right polarity to the radio. That's one way it could be done, a full-wave bridge rectifier. I'm looking at my TS-670. This is a 6-meter all-mode rig, 6-meter and a couple other bands, and I did make the mistake of wiring that backwards, and it's got a great big diode directly from 12 volts to ground on the input B-plus connector, the 12-volt connector. Great big diode, which if you put reverse polarity into that rig, that diode goes into the conduct mode and blows the fuse, and I did that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I purchased these bilateral diodes, and basically it's a Zener diode, but works two different ways. If you reverse the wires, as you say, it immediately will blow the fuse. In the forward mode of the diode, it's a Zener. In other words, I purchased 15-volt bilateral diode. If the voltage exceeds 15 volts for any reason, which then would definitely damage the radio, it can't tolerate, even 15 is really pushing it to the end, the number of the radios. In a forward mode, it's a Zener, and it'll blow the fuse. So either way, you're protected, over voltage or under, or reversing. That's basically what the bilateral diode. The single diode looks like any regular rectifier diode, but that's its purpose, called the bilateral diode. Over.
If a modern-day radio, ML, was designed for mobile service, where ordinarily when your automobile is in its charge mode, the alternator's running, the motor's running, and you're tooling down the road at 50 miles an hour, That alternator is turning out 13.8 volts on a summer day, and I think it's turning out something like 14.2 volts on a winter day. So, without a doubt, a mobile rig intended for mobile service has no trouble tolerating 14.2 volts, and as you're operating the starter motor and turning on the lights and whatever, or you're doing turning on your windshield wipers, there's heavy inductive loads alternately being applied. Therefore, various spikes are being generated on that 12-volt supply of that automobile. Therefore, I'd like to believe that a well-designed automobile mobile rig can easily tolerate 17 and 18-volt spikes for brief periods of time. Therefore, if you put a 15-volt power Zener in there, I think you're pretty safe. And I guess bilateral means that the Zener is specifically designed to take a few amperes briefly at 15 volts, and with reverse polarity, take quite a few amperes, enough to blow a fuse. So is it literally called a bilateral fuse? In other words, it has a current rating in both directions. Is that what it is, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
That's what they refer to it in the place where, you know, I purchased it from. They refer to it bilateral diodes. I have to look at one of them here. I can take a look and give you a little bit more info on it. It's basically a very good protective device for radios, similar to the Yaesu 817. I don't know about all the other radios, but as a precaution, I have put this across a few of those 12-volt radios that I had, I don't know, some questions in my mind, Dick. It's so easy to stick that diode across and relieve your mind that you're protecting the radio over.
Oh, you're absolutely right. In the case of my 617, and I realized that I had hooked it up backwards, in theory, I could have blown out an awful lot of very expensive computing and silicon operating transistors in there by the reverse polarity if it wasn't for that great big protection diode. Let's see what who was that?
Ed, K2GJE.
Go ahead, Ed.
The alternators on today's cars are three wire alternators. The heavy wire goes directly to the battery to charge it, of course. I believe it's terminal one is the idiot light, tells you if you're charging or not charging. And terminal two is the sense line. Let me drop. The sense line on many cars goes to a large terminal. It usually has a boot over it. You don't see it. At that point, the alternator senses the voltage and tries to make it constant at that sense terminal by varying what it's doing at the battery. I think this is the place where mobile equipment should be hooked up. And many of the dealers, some of them may not accommodate you, they have diagrams how to connect auxiliary equipment because cars are used for more than one purpose. Over.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions on this one, Ed. That sensing point is how many feet away from the battery with what gauge wire? If it was 1 foot away with a piece of 8-gauge wire, I wouldn't worry. If it's 10 feet away with a piece of 14-gauge wire, I would worry. I really want the 1 farad-like filter capacitor characteristic of the battery to be on the wiring that goes to my particular 180-watt amplifier. The Mirage Baker 1016 really puts out 180 watts in my case. So, I want to be as close to the battery as possible, and if I've got some number of milliohms or ohms between the battery and that sense point, then I'm afraid that there's a couple of things that are going to happen. I'm going to get a voltage drop when I draw the 20 amperes of turning on the amplifier. Second of all, any RF energy that's on my 12-volt wiring, when it hits the battery directly, the 1 farad of the battery is going to run short at the ground real fast. If there's any real inductance in the wiring to that sense point, I'm now putting 144 megacycle energy into all the wiring of my instrument panel, and I think I could get myself in trouble. So I'm not so happy about going to that sense point with my high-power amplifier. You might have an opinion on this one, Ed. Over to you, Ed, K2LIW.
I totally agree with you, Dick, but you have to look into your particular vehicle, and you have to get some input from your dealer, and if your dealer won't help you, go to another dealer. I have an old Chevy that was intended for New York Port Authority, but the dealer had to buy so many vehicles evidently to get the fleet price. The sense point is no more than a foot away from the, and it's quite a substantial piece of wire. It's definitely heavier than 8. It may be something like 4. You're going to have to look into each vehicle on an individual basis, and you may have to increase the gauge from the sense point to the battery. Over.
Very fine, Ed. If you're correct and that's only a 1 foot away and it's a piece of something like 4-gauge wire, I'm going to stop worrying. Because my favorite way of wiring my high-power amplifier is 8-gauge. And if they got something all heavier than that and only a foot of it, then I'm going to agree. I think that's okay. I hope Paul is still with us. We hope we haven't put him to sleep. And some exciting things took place. This is the one time in history, Paul, where when Gemini ran out, when the Mercury program ran out, Gemini was already on the launch pad ready to go. When Gemini ran out, Apollo was on the launch pad ready to go. When Apollo was coming to the end, Skylab was on the launch pad ready to go. When Skylab ran out, the space shuttle was on the launch pad ready to go. So all of NASA's history, we had something that was replacing the old with the new. And this is the first time in history where all of a sudden we're abandoning the shuttle, we burned the bridge, and we've got nowhere to go for some number of years. That's a rather uncomfortable feeling. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
Can I say one final word, Dick?
Let Mel go.
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, the diode is called, I just put the envelope, if anyone's interested in it, it's called a Zener Overvoltage Transient Suppressor Unidirectional Diode. Zener Overvoltage Transient Suppressor Unidirectional Diode. And it's available from a number on the ECG numbers. You look up whatever particular one you're looking for. But that's what's called Zener Overvoltage Transient Suppressor Unidirectional Diode. Over.
Where did you buy it from? Roughly how many dollars? And what's your guess? You think that'll take a 5 ampere spike? Mel, go ahead.
Saw it in some article somewhere. And it sold. DigiKey has got it, and the other ones, you know, they all have it in there. No problem finding it, Dick. They all, I guess DigiKey is the easiest one, or one of those others is most likely you would know exactly what it is, be in their catalog. Over.
Roughly how many dollars, and does it have a heat sink? Over to you, Mel.
No heat sink. I don't think it was very much, maybe about $2.25, $2.25, 30 cents. Pretty cheap. Looks like a rectifier diode, but I tried it, of course. First thing I did is I wanted to see if it worked as a Zener. Then I reversed it. As soon as you reverse it, you can see you got a short over.
Roughly how big is the thing? Does it look like a half-watt resistor?
No. More like an old-fashioned 1-watt carbon. 1 watt? Let me see. Half watt, quarter watt, half watt. Yeah, about 1 watt. About an old-fashioned 1-watt carbon.
And Alan Bradley, well done. Okay, Sounds like it's got some beef to it. You got it, Paul, and I wonder if you're as uncomfortable as I am that we don't have anything to replace our beautiful shuttle. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW.
K2 Mike, Mike Yankee with a question.
We won't be able to take your question immediately. We may have to wait. You may have to wait until next week. We've got a schedule, if you know what I mean. Your number run on the one way next week. What's the prefix to Mike Yankee?
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Yankee, no problem. I didn't realize we're on the schedule. Thanks.
Yeah, people sign in at 8 o'clock. We promise that we're going to answer all the questions between 8 o'clock and roughly 9 or so. After that, we're going to get into the deeper subjects.
B, C.
And Bob's there also. Mike Yankee, if you can hang around, there's a chance we can squeeze you in after the space report. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
Hey, Curry, you guys? Yeah, let him say, stand by. We won't be that long. One little correction. We went from Mercury to Gemini to Apollo to Skylab, but there was a 6-year lag between the end of Skylab, which was 1974, 1975, to 1981. So you had a 6-year lag for the shuttle, but it was on the drawing board, in the 70s. So it was up and running, being built. The same here, where we kind of have something on the drawing board. It's called Orion, but Orion is now being morphed into something else, a multi-functional crew vehicle, basically the same thing. So this thing is being planned for 21-day flights, which means that you'll be able to go to geosynchronous orbit maybe to repair a satellite. You'll be eventually able to dock with another craft, a Habitat craft, and go to the moon. Let me drop it. I'd be able to dock with another Habitat module and go off to Mars. They've got thoughts of going to asteroids and things like that, but it would be nice to be able to get out to the 1 million mile mark and service something. You've got the James Webb telescope going up in a few years, which is going to Lagrange Point 2, which is about 1 million miles away from Earth, not orbiting the Earth per se, actually one orbit per year. Sitting at that point, 4 times the distance of the moon. You've got a shuttle now, which only goes a couple hundred miles up. I think top orbit is like 600 miles. That doesn't get you 1 million miles or even 22,000 miles for a geosynchronous orbit to repair something. So you've got a shot with this new crew vehicle, which might be minimum 5 years down the road. Let me drop it. We've got SpaceX developing craft now for resupplying the International Space Station and eventually powering up to bring up crews to the space station. Again, maybe cargo, maybe 2 years down the road. People, minimum 5 years to the space station, I think, to bring crews from American soil, minimum. You might be looking at a 10-year lag, which would be a shame. But that's it. You've got other countries that are involved with resupplying the International Space Station with cargo. Let me drop it, WS2N. Got Japan with the H2 resupply vehicle, which is very similar to the Russian Progress vehicle. Both are cargo vehicles, bringing roughly 6,000 pounds up to the space station at a time. could be done every 3 months or so. You've got the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle by European Space Agency, bigger, much bigger than the Japanese or the Progress, but you know, maybe three or four times the weight that could be brought up for that, but not as often. You know, if you're gonna get an ATV up there, maybe it's gonna be once every 8 months or so. Docks at the station, they put all the garbage on board, similar to the Progress missions, and they deorbit it, and it burns up over the Pacific. These are not reusable spacecraft like the shuttle. So we'll have to see, Dick. It's going to be interesting when we drop it. For manned space flight, what we're going to do, put a net here, is just basically follow the International Space Station. The crews will be going up, $60 million a pop, giving money to the Russians. For now, we've done it before. We had a big lag of time after Columbia burnt up in the atmosphere. We had a couple of years there that we spent all that money for seats on the Russian spacecraft. We were doing it all along, even when the shuttle was running. So it's not new. We did it for many years after Challenger blew up in '86. So we'll be, you know, we do have a manned space program. Really cut back. We drop it. We've got a shuttle which can bring up usually seven people. Most it ever had was eight on board. You know, standard procedure was seven. Russian Soyuz craft is three. Always commanded by a Russian, of course. And there's always two seats available, usually one by an American and one by the European Space Agency, which consists of 16 different countries, so you might have one go up from Japan, one France, so on. So that's what we're left with there, but we'll concentrate on the net anyway, on robotic missions. You know, you still have Mars rovers riding around. Well, one anyway, Spirit is dead. Opportunity is still good. You've got a new flight going up in November, Curiosity. Let me drop it. Months later, it will land on Mars with its sky crane attachment. It's not going to land like the previous rovers with using airbags. It's going to come down with a parachute, separate from a back shell, and you're going to have a spacecraft come out of what they call a sky crane, with eight rockets attached to it. It's going to, you know, after the parachute separates, these rockets are going to come on, and then it's going to drop the Curiosity rover, not drop, but lower it from its body, on these cables, and then it's going to actually land that way. You're going to have eight rockets firing, and then as you get closer to the surface, it'll be down to four rockets, and these things are set around 45 degrees, actually it's about 40 degrees off from the center, so it doesn't burn up the rocket below, Curiosity below as it's landing. After it lands, 2 seconds later, you drop it. Cables will be cut with these guillotine type connections. Cables will be cut from Curiosity. The data cables will be cut, and the rocket will take off. And it looks like it's going back into orbit, but it's not. It'll be flying away from the rover to allow it to drive on Mars without getting tangled up in the cables. So you've got plenty of missions such as that, such as Juno. Juno will be going into polar, Jupiter orbit, launched in August, a couple of years to get there, and quite a few other missions, you know, that we'll talk about, the James Webb Space Telescope, the Grail mission, that's going to be an orbiting moon mission, all unmanned, and we'll concentrate on this, these robotic missions for now, on the space part of the platform. Dick, back to you, WS1.
I think I read that the astronauts are going to be linking up with the shuttle, with the space station, Sunday evening, which is tonight. So I think by now they've already linked. I think there's only four astronauts on board. I'm guessing they're going to be at the space station for probably something like 8 days. Let's see, the space station, I think, can turn out something like 38,000 watts of electrical power. Therefore, they can power the shuttle. The shuttle doesn't have to use its consumables. Therefore, if they wanted to, they could probably stay almost 2 weeks, couldn't they, Paul? Go ahead.
38K per set of panels. I think it's four times that amount. But yeah, they could extend the mission. In fact, it's a 12-day mission. They've already got another day planned. It might go beyond that. But you could go 3-4 days extra. Years ago, they used to power everything from the fuel cells aboard the space shuttle, and now they, every time they dock, they have the equivalent of jumper cables, which power the space shuttle with the abundant extra supply of solar power that they have from the ISS. And one good thing is you can really see this thing go overhead. I mean, two Thursdays ago, not last Thursday, the Thursday before that, they had a pass go, I mean, it was a real zenith pass for Long Island. There had to be 90 degrees right above us, and it was one of those really clear blue sky nights. And I watched this thing go overhead. I couldn't believe it. I mean, that was the best pass ever. So, and that's without the shuttle attached. So the shuttle adds to that when it's attached. But you don't need the shuttle attached. This thing's big. This is a football field flying overhead there. And some people with good eyes, my daughter said that, you know, she could actually, with the resolution that she could see, she could actually see that solar wings coming out to some degree. It wasn't round as far as she's concerned. As far as I'm concerned, it's round, but I'm older. That was pretty cool. Dropping.
Was it approximately as bright as Venus from your eye, Paul?
I would say equal to. I would say touch brighter than Venus. Bring in another magnitude higher than that, or actually lower. Magnitude, when you go down in magnitude, actually that's you can see it better. You mentioned the four-person crew. Yeah, the reason for that, a lot of people are wondering about that. I have people ask me. Usually it's a seven-person crew or maybe a five-person crew to service the Hubble Space Station, Space Telescope. But this time you have a four-person crew. They haven't done that since 83. But there's a good reason for it. The previous missions, they always had shuttles that would be always, you know, in the vehicle assembly building or maybe even on a pad that could actually go up and rescue an existing space shuttle for the last few years, ever since Columbia. And now you can't do that. I mean, you'd send up a two-person crew and you'd bring back everybody. You could do that. Let me drop it. Now it's a four-person crew because there are no more space shuttles left. These things are being ripped apart, and getting ready to be put into museums, not into outer space. So this is you know, the one and only up there, Atlantis, with no rescue in sight. If there was a problem, if the tiles got ripped off on launch, for instance, and they saw a whole bunch of tiles. Oh, by the way, yeah, they are docked there. They are docked with the space station. You would have to have these, each astronaut would be coming back solo on each Soyuz mission that goes up. We drop it to WS2N. Over the period of the next year, for instance, if the shuttle had to be abandoned, it would take roughly a little less, but about a year. Before you get everybody back, they would fly like one at a time. They'd fly a Soyuz mission up with two on board instead of three, and bring back one astronaut at a time. So that's the deal. You know, you have to have, the flight rules are, however many people on board the space station, if you have to abandon the space station for fire or whatever reason, media hits it, you need as many seats to leave. In fact, when they do a spacewalk, let me drop it, and when they do a spacewalk, and let's say the shuttle's not up there, and they're doing some work outside, you'll have, let's say, two people will be going out to do a spacewalk. Everybody else is sitting in a Soyuz spacecraft, actually just killing time while they're doing a spacewalk. And in case there's a problem, they could deorbit and come back to Earth. So another piece of information, or what they plan. You know, they really plan ahead when they do this stuff. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
How many astronauts are on the ISS right now, and how many Soyuz are capable of acting as lifeboats to bring them back home? Over to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, that's an easy one, Dick. We have 10 up there now. You have a permanent crew of 6, and now 4 just docked. So if there's a problem, 4 will bail out on the space shuttle, and you have 2 Soyuz spacecraft up there, each craft capable of holding 3. So there you go. And there's also a progress dock up there as well. They gotta go somewhere with all this garbage. Could you imagine how much garbage there is with 6 people? You know, I mean, they're good about it, but there's a lot of garbage in it. And then, you know, thousands of pounds every 3 months get deorbited from the space station and burnt up over the Pacific Ocean.
So I get the impression now that there are 4 astronauts on the shuttle. 4 astronauts in 12 days are going to come back down. The 6 that are on the ISS are going to stay there. And the 6 do have those 2 lifeboats of Soyuz craft, 3 seats each. So they do have the ability to abandon ship if need be. And exactly 4, the same 4 that went up intend to come back down. And I guess whatever installation they're doing, they needed 4 to do that. Is that true?
QSL. Well, they would have sent more up, but they you know, that's not within the flight plans, you know. That's why they only sent 4 up. In case there was an emergency, they would stay on board and come down one at a time. So, I mean, you know, that would be an emergency situation. So, they'd be outside their flight rules at that time. But, you know, what are you going to do? You still have the space that, you know, the maybe the shuttle, you know, they could hang out in there for a while. But if there was an emergency, I guess they'd have real problems. Yeah, there's two Soyuz spacecraft. You can't come back on a progress. That's not, you know, that's not manned. And they really, I mean, they plan ahead to the point where every astronaut that goes up, you need a certain size seat for each individual astronaut, width, height, and the seats, like you have four astronauts, each one has, they bring up their seats, you know, they always talk about they're bringing up the water and they're bringing up this and that, food and supplies. Well, one of the things that they bring up is seats. Let me drop it.
Yeah. Is there any possibility when the shuttle comes back that they could bring more than four if for some reason they wanted to? I think you're saying they might not have the seats to do that.
Yeah, well, again, that would be an emergency situation. In other words, if the shuttle failed, that was just saying, but the, you know, right now you've got a permanent, you always have now a permanent crew of six. You'll have that for the next 10, 20 years. But actually, the end of the ISS is probably 15 years out, but that'll be extended. But yeah, you'll always have a crew of six. It's weird how it all evolved. I mean, it started off with eight. They were going to have eight when they call this thing the Freedom, but that name went away, and then they just called it the ISS, and they eventually dropped it down to six. Permanent crew, but for a lot of years, you know, we had three up there. I mean, you know, then we went up. We had three for. We got to Columbia. Let me drop it. CS-107, and when that thing burnt up over the over Texas, they went from a, you know, they were up to three. Oh, they were doing good, heading for six. Because of that, supplies ran low, and they had to really stretch things out. They left only a two-person crew up. I mean, for the next couple of years, one guy would come back, and another shuttle, Soyuz would go up. And, I mean, they just left it as a two-person crew. Got back up to three, and then once they had the last solar panels, up there. Then they went to a permanent group, six-person crew. But right now you have 10 in orbit. Dick.
It sounds like they're not planning to come down with anything more than the four that went up. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer that was installed on the last shuttle mission. Have we heard any words as to how well that's working? Paul, go ahead.
I don't know. I heard it was going to take 6 months to get the it's apparently some kind of calibrating that's going on with this thing. But I heard it's going to take 6 months to get that going. But I mean, once it's going, it's not like a, you know, it's basically infrared. Any other infrared telescopes that have been sent up are always cryogenically cooled, and eventually they run out of helium, which is doing the cryogenics. So they only last, you know, 2-3 years, and then at the most, and that's the end of that Kobe satellite and things like that. It 2-3 years, that's it. Even the WMAP, they don't have that longevity, because helium, no matter what you do with helium, you cannot contain this stuff. Helium, the atoms are so small, they will get out of right through the pipes. I mean, right through the walls of the pipes. You cannot contain it. So it has a certain lifetime to it. But what was good with this thing, with this telescope, which is all bolted to the space station, pointing up, it's good forever. I mean, it's good as long as the space station is there. That's good. I mean, they did it without using cryogenics. Back here.
So no cryogenics on the detectors, no cryogenics on the superconducting magnet. The throttle back on the magnetic requirement made that a non-superconducting magnet, so they get much more longevity out of it. Sounds like a fun project. And so four astronauts on the shuttle went up. The exact same four are going to come back down. The six that are there are going to stay there. The longest that we've had an American on the ISS is, what, about 18 months, I'm going to guess, Paul, and my guess is after 18 months he may have had a little bit of trouble walking again. Over to you, Paul.
Now, the longest American was at one time was Shannon Lucid, a woman. and she made it, I think close to 200 days. There's one guy, oh, I wish I could think of his name. He spent almost a year, 300 and some odd days up there, close to a year. But collectively, that was over three different flights. You have a Russian that spent 400 and some odd days on Mir. He was the commander on that one. So that's the record. The Russian got the record for staying up there. You don't want to do that really on a continuous basis. Right now they still haven't solved this bone loss problem. So every year, what is it, 3 months in space, you lose 3% of your bone mass or something like that. So, you know, up there a year, you're gonna come down with like 12% less bone mass. So you don't want to do this on a regular basis until they get this gravity thing worked out there.
Any of these guys with very long duration in space on any one mission, would it be correct to assume that the reacclimation to the Earth was a little bit lengthy?
WB2IKT with a comment on the James Webb Telescope.
IKT recognized, but Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
How many times they come back, and you know, they've got this contraption. It's on scissor jack, you know, and it goes out to the shuttle after it lands, and it rises up, meets the door, you know, kind of like what you would have in an airport, you know, for getting out of the door of an airplane. But you know, it's what they do is they send crews in to take these people out. And some of them, you know, especially the ones that had not been on the ISS for, you know, 3, 4, 5 months at a time, you know, you might have been on the crew that just went up there and just came back. And you know, you're up there for 12, 13, 14 days like this mission. And they'll get out and they'll walk around and check out the spacecraft. You know, they'll get into this contraption and get out, you know, right away. But, you know, there's always one or two that, some of them that just went up in a week or two, and you don't see them come out, you know. They stay in this thing, and this thing drives back, and they're stretched out. So that happens a lot. Happened to John Glenn. Dropping. He's older. I mean, it happens to, you know, probably 10-20% of the crews that go up there. That they, especially when they come back after being on the ISS that long, when they land in Kazakhstan, you know, they come down in a Soyuz craft and they take them out of there. I mean, they lay there like, you know, like three dead eggs. Some of them, you know, they can't move, and the helicopters come out and they find, you know, they land on land, they'll pull them out. By the way, that's what they want to do with the future capsule-like design. They should be landing on land and not in the ocean, like the Apollo missions and the Soyuz and Mercury and Gemini. They want to eventually land our people on land like they do with the Russians. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. George, tell us about the James Webb. So B2IKT, you got it. K2RIW.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. This is WB2IKT, and I'm sorry, but it looks like it's bad news. The House Appropriations Committee has decided not to fund the James Webb Space Telescope, and they're suggesting that it be killed. The current budget is $6.5 billion for the telescope, and the timetable has been pushed back. Assuming it was funded, it would be ready in the year 2015. And NASA sort of disagreed with that. They said probably 2018. Nobody believes that the money was wasted. They thought the money was well spent. But overall, NASA just can't afford that kind of money. So $6.5 billion, and it looks like it's not going to be continued. So if people want to continue, now's the time. to talk about its value and write to congressmen and all that good stuff. But it looks like the House will not choose to fund James Webb going on in the future.
Not good news. Roughly how recent